Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustino. With us this week is Nick Rangel. She is the executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. You can find them at www.lasnny.org. And they serve the constituents of 14 New York State Assembly districts and 8 New York State Senate districts in Northeastern New York. Nick Rangel, always a pleasure. Welcome back to the Capital Connection.
It's really wonderful to be here. Thank you so much.
I wanted to start with your mission statement. And what you do, quite frankly, is civil legal aid, a combination of services and resources that helps people to effectively navigate the justice system in civil cases. Essentially, you're a law firm for poor and low-income people. You provide free assistance and representation in civil non-criminal cases. There's no cost for any of the services they provide, and you believe that everyone has the right to equal justice regarding the ability to pay. Now, equal justice, inclusiveness, equity for all, the idea of diversity, equity, inclusion is within your own mission statement, and I bring it up right off the top because that's what the Trump administration is trying to get rid of. Diversity, equity, inclusion. This is a serious issue and one that you've been fielding questions on since the orders came through.
Yes, of course. And I've spent countless hours reading and analyzing and researching the executive orders on this topic. There's a theme to the executive orders. There's the start, it kind of sets out an opinion or position, some concepts that the president holds near and dear. And then it gives directives to its cabinet to execute based on that lens, that new lens that's being applied to current and existing law. So as much as they are, you know, legal proclamations, they haven't changed the statutes that exist in federal law or in state law. And I think that's really an important foundation that equal opportunity has not changed in statute. Anti-harassment and discrimination laws have not changed in statute. And the obligation on my organization and nonprofits under tax code have not changed in statute. And the regulations that govern the funding that we receive from the various governmental entities haven't changed their regulations. And so when I think about what kind of changes are mandated, are really truly required, I'm focusing more on what is our risk tolerance to having an investigation brought to that, you know, by a federal body into my tax compliance, not what is my legal obligation into DEI programming, right? Because the DEI programming, we have direct funding that requires certain types of DEI activities. DEI is not defined in law. It's an idea. And so what nonprofits are doing largely is making sure we're in compliance, making sure we're squeaky clean, making sure our audits are squeaky clean, making sure that our hiring practices don't inadvertently have any kind of language in the process or procedure that would lend somebody to think there's some kind of prioritization, which with us there's not, and with most organizations there is not. There's not really any such thing anymore as quota hiring. For example, it's like, you know, you don't see hiring preferences in any kind of documentation that says I need to hire this number of people with these identities or these protected classes. Like, that's not happening anywhere. But what we are also doing is trying to We're doing sort of audits of our online presence to try to reduce the vulnerability to us and to other organizations that we're partners with around what we are all calling kind of trigger words. And so there are conversations around having a lower profile online on our website, which is not where most people learn about the deep-rooted community relationships that we have anyway, but changing some of the language on our like external communications on websites, but then enhancing and amplifying our work on the ground, doing more community building and relationship building, doing more interviews like this to talk about how important we believe and feel that equity and access to justice is crucial to the justice system universally and to the provision of civil legal services. So that's where our conversations, you know, kind of intersect. Yes, we have to consider trigger words. No, we are not backing away from our commitment to access to justice and equity and inclusion as part of that formula.
So you have to be willing to move and shift with the political winds, but are you more vulnerable or are you, do you feel safer because you're in a state like New York, a blue state, where you might get some extra funding as a result or at least the climate where you can do your work?
So I think on the vulnerability is the external communications. There are Gen AI bots that can find those trigger words in an instant.
Give us a trigger word.
Race equity.
Yeah.
Right. So they find that trigger word in an instant, and then they can identify the, you know, the organization. They can find archived pages on that website. They can find edits to pages that were made through those tools. So you can't just take a page down or just edit a page. They know that we had a page that said race equity at some point, right? What we can do is think more strategically, which we have been doing and I would say should always have been doing, is think about DEI in a different way. I think about an equity budget internally, on how do I actually encourage more diverse employment? And I do that by providing mental health and health services for free through an enhanced EAP plan. I do it by having flexible work schedules and work from home technologies. I do it by enhancing training and professional development at all levels of staff, not just the attorneys or just the professional staff. So thinking about the how to achieve DEI just evolves and has evolved and should continue to evolve. So the words don't really matter. It's the actions in a nutshell, right? And we're talking about how do we make those actions more impactful and more meaningful. Externally, it does mean doing more outreach, more community engagement, working more closely with really vulnerable nonprofits and community-based organizations, those smaller organizations that are going to have less resilience or less ability to be resilient in the face of federal funding cuts and changes in state priorities, and try to find ways to support those organizations. So we're doing more Pride activities this year and sponsoring more Pride events this year than ever before, basically with that in mind. As far as budget vulnerability, I don't think there is any level of response to DEI changes that will save anybody's dollars. There is no universe where an organization can just say, we stopped doing DEI, and that is the thing that will save their money. And we can see that in the Trump budget, in the federal administration's budget proposal, that initial proposal effectively zeroes out the vast majority of discretionary funding for all of the programs, programs that most people really don't think of as DEI programs, but are in fact DEI programs. It's veteran supports, it's senior nutrition, it's housing access.
What about legal aid services for the poor?
Legal aid services, victims, crime victims,
yes.
And domestic violence victims. Like, people don't really think about those as DEI programs. And yet those funds are just being zeroed out, you know, by this administration's priorities. Now, we do see that, you know, there's a long way to go before there's a federal budget. In his first administration, this was the budget we saw then, too. He zeroed out everything that could be considered discretionary and then demanded dramatic cuts in even the non-discretionary funding and then sent Congress out to go find those cuts. And so we have seen this playbook. I do think there are differences this time around compared to the first administration, that there is a stronger coalition that will demand a final budget that has deeper cuts than what Congress actually adopted in his first term. So as much as organizations have sort of budgeted or tried to play out some expectation of, you know, 20% cut to civil legal services, I think we'll see much deeper cuts in it, because they'll be deeper in all of the other departments. We have a low-income taxpayer program through the Treasury. It just helps low-income people handle their taxes. It is not a DEI program at all, but it will likely see some federal funding cuts, right? And so now we're thinking more broadly, where are we going to see those cuts and how much of an impact will that have on us and on the state of New York?
I wonder how you feel, Nick Rangel, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, about the larger issue here, which is that this presidential administration, the Trump administration, doesn't want to see us visit our mistakes. So if there are a lot of systemic problems in our society that create inequity, lack of diversity, and lack of inclusion, you can trace those into all areas, including legal aid for poor people. But they're trying to argue that there are no inequities. There is no need to level the playing field. And I wonder how you feel about the philosophical underpinnings of what they're doing here.
Well, I think it's important to note that at no point has the administration specifically identified how it defines DEI. And I just want to kind of level set. The D in diversity has been a, you know, post-segregation concept that industry and higher education have come to accept and know that they need more literal bodies to fill jobs. They need more people for more innovation and creativity. They need more people for competition. And that by having more diversity in the workforce and in higher education, there was improved sales, products that appealed to more consumers, because you had the cultural and community insight from more kinds of pockets of people. And then we have equal employment opportunity laws that focused on the numbers for decades. But they were seeing that even with, you know, anti-discrimination laws, they weren't achieving meaningful gains in diversity in key areas, right? And so the DEI movement came about to help to achieve the how. How do we get women, and early on it was focused on women, right? How do you get women into jobs and moving up the ladder and into C-suite jobs? And that's where equity and inclusion start to become part of that conversation. And we all watched Hidden Figures, right? The movie about Black women who were instrumental in NASA
computers.
And computers, right? And the DEI moment there was the moment when their manager realized that they didn't have a bathroom to use near their workstations, because diversity was having Black women work there, but equity and inclusion was having a bathroom they could use during the workday. And amazingly, we're still talking about bathrooms, right? Now take bathrooms and extrapolate. If you have women in the workforce who are primary caregivers, how do they work on a 9-to-5 when school class schedules are 8-to-4? It's not possible. The two things don't complement each other. So the E and I of DEI is having a work schedule that aligns with the typical school schedule. I don't think that that's what this administration identifies as DEI. I don't think people really connect that those are the results of DEI. People are misapplying DEI to this other concept, which is preferencing or giving protected classes a leg up in some way. But the truth is, it's just leveling the playing field. It is just making sure people have access to the job that their cis, white, male, non-primary caregiving counterpart has access to, and thinking differently about what does the industry actually need from me? Do they really need me there 9 to 5? Or does the industry need me there as a Hispanic woman because I'm a Hispanic woman, and maybe the industry needs to change a little bit to facilitate my involvement?
She is Nick Rangel, the executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. That's www.lasnny.org. You guys help a lot of people. In fact, you're available at 833-628-0087. I imagine you get lots of questions, legal questions for folks. What rises to the top for you? Can you put a face on this? Can you give us an example of someone who reached out and what you're able to do at Legal Services for them?
Yeah, of course. So LASNY covers 16 counties from Columbia County up to Canada. It's geographically about 30% of the state, and most of our service area is remote and rural across the Adirondack Park. Our largest programs really focus on housing. That's eviction prevention, foreclosure prevention. We have large programs in family law, domestic violence, crime victims. We have a large program in disability advocacy. So those are folks who have a disability and have been denied their disability application to SSA, the Social Security Administration. We have about 13 different practice areas. They include, as I mentioned earlier, the low-income taxpayer clinics. We do consumer rights, veterans work, worker protection. A number of programs, really. Our budget last year, about a little more than 22 or 23% of our budget is federal or federal pass-through funding. A lot of that funding is, again, the victim services tax, HUD, and then through our federal partner, the Legal Services Corporation, which is not an agency. It's an independent nonprofit, but it receives all of its appropriations through the federal budget. At the state level, you know, the majority of our funding comes from the state or state agencies. Our budget last year was, I want to say it was around $18 million to $20 million. And I just want to read this stat. LASNY's economic impact in 2024 was $86,447,000. That's the money that we saved taxpayers by both bringing in federal funds that were due to New Yorkers through our disability advocacy, helping keep people housed, keeping homeowners in their homes and paying their mortgages, defending workers who've been victims of wage theft, a number, helping families get started after a divorce or a domestic violence incident and addressing their custodial and child care issues. So, you know, the economic impact dollar for dollar for legal services is like 1 to 4. I mean, it's very, very incredible. And we are continuing to build relationships and try to kind of address the rural legal access gap by being in those harder to reach, more remote areas more frequently and more visibly. We're doing a strategic plan right now and hoping to identify we're doing a needs assessment as part of that and hoping to identify areas of our service area that we could invest more resources into. So, you know, really putting those funds to good use. Last year, we handled 8,442 cases, and that benefited 17,896 people. I mean, that's households with children who are not homeless and did not have to leave a school district, or whose kid got the disability benefits they need so that their parent can go to work. Just tremendous life-saving services that a lot of people don't even know are legal in nature, but that we're here to help with. I think we've done 4 name change and gender marker changes this year.
Explain that a little more.
So we have funding and partnerships that support the name and gender marker changes for transgender people across our service area.
Are you worried about that?
Sure are. Sure, we are. And what I would say is, even though we are doing the work that our grant asks us to do, right, the people who are receiving those services are facing tremendous legal challenges to what the implication is of having a name that doesn't match a birth certificate, mm-hmm. potentially, or under this administration, a gender identity that wasn't assigned to them at birth, which at the federal level is at odds with New York State law and the New York State Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And this is complicated, and it leaves a lot of people in a legal limbo.
Yeah, it sure does. And of course, you say you're covering about 30% of New York, but there are similar agencies, similar organizations across the state, right, that you can refer people to if that's where they should go for those services.
There are hundreds of programs. I encourage everyone to start their search for legal help at lawhelpny.org. It is the universal legal service and support service agency service search engine for the state and for the country. So there's a Law Help in every state. Pro Bono Net is this really amazing organization. They support Law Help. And in New York, you just put your zip code in and it tells you, and then you can say, I'm looking for housing, I'm looking for domestic violence, I'm looking for tax help, I'm looking for veteran help. And it'll tell you every agency that serves your zip code. In most of our service area, there are not very many other legal service programs in our service area, particularly in the North Country. But in Rochester, there's tons. In the city, there's tons. And so I do just always encourage people to start there.
And what about the fact that you've touted these statistics that show the money you're saving and the help you're providing in the community? A lot of organizations do that when they lobby legislators to show their impact and why they need their funds renewed.
Doesn't lobby, we educate.
Yes, you do. You are definitely seeking access so you can get your educational message across. But the bottom line is the bottom line. Will you see that $18, $19 million renewed in the budget?
In the federal budget, we're anticipating cuts for sure. And we've tried to game that out in our internal adopted budget and in our 3-year funding plan. Everybody's trying to game it out. It's really difficult to game that out. We started with sort of a 15 or 20% expectation of reduced funding by federal entities. As the year has progressed, it's looking more stark. I really can't tell where that lands. What is true is that the majority of the federal dollars we get for civil legal services helps red counties, essentially, right? The work we're doing in, let's say, Lasny, most of my service area is represented by Republican lawmakers.
We're finding this out all over the country, by the way.
Sure. And so most of the federal dollars that we receive at Lasny serves Republican counties.
What about the state dollars?
There are several scenarios. Currently, our state funding looks really promising. It looks really good. Our major state funders are through the homeowner protection, which was included in the governor's budget and in the one houses and looks really safe. Disability advocacy program, DAP program, that funding looks really safe. The judiciary funds look really safe. There might even be some new funding around kinship care legal services, which would be really fun. There's some new funding for housing access vouchers. The HAVP program, I think, is going to be included, which is, kind of an interesting project. It's kind of similar to the SAFE project that they adopted last year. It's got some seed money to see how it does.
So how much are you getting from the state so far?
So about two-thirds of our dollars come, a little more than two-thirds of our dollars come from state, directly state funds.
You think they'll all be replenished?
The way it looks right now, yes. What happens if the federal adopted budget severely cuts funding to the state of New York? That's a different universe. And there's not really a good way to game that out because of how impactful it could be, hypothetically, and then how much of that would be caught up in legal processes and procedures. Right?
And the state budget process is, I think, a sign of that in many ways. They're not sure how this is all going to play out at the federal level. Will they be back in a special session?
I suspect they will. If Congress passes a budget in the fall, then states will have to respond to that landscape change if it is substantial, which would likely mean a special in the fall. I think what's challenging is to see not just whether dollars themselves are cut, but if the administration is frustrated, if changing in staffing frustrates the purpose of the dollars. Social Security Administration has had staffing levels reduced at the federal level. They've had offices closed in our region, and then they've changed the in-person requirements.
That's right.
So even if funding stays substantially similar, we still are seeing people have a harder time accessing the benefits they have a right to have.
Especially if your office is closed and you have to find another office further away that you have to be in person.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. We have a client who was declared deceased by SSA, and they are in fact not deceased. And then they've had to go in person and prove that they are in fact alive and doing okay, but could be better if their benefits were not cut. And
wow.
It's the administrative changes, I think, that have a more acute like impact on individual humans, that they can't get to the office. They can't prove they're alive, you know.
Well, I can prove that you're alive here in our studio, and you are Nick Rangel, the executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. We're going to get you back. We're going to find out how all this plays out. I know it's kind of pins and needles, and you're working hard. Nick Rangel, we can only hope you'll be back with better news next time.
You know, whatever the news is, Legal Aid Society's been here for 100 years, and we will continue to do the work we do to the best of our ability. And I appreciate the time and seeing you here today.
Thank you. Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.